Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Natural gas production is on the rise in Pennsylvania and West Virginia, and energy companies are racing to build pipelines that could transport gas to markets along the East Coast.
Production has outpaced anybody's wildest expectations. When you look back 4 or 5 years ago, we far exceeded the projections.
We need to be exporting our natural gas, our LNG. One of the biggest markets is going to be exporting. So you see how it all works together?
The gas, it's not going to benefit us whatsoever, and it'll be running 2 billion cubic feet of gas a day through our county that's headed to export terminals. Why should we destroy our county so somebody else can benefit from it?
We'll have these stories and more inside Appalachia.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed them all. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread?
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Often on our show, we hear about people who are trying to maintain hope in the midst of what many across the country would probably consider a life of poverty or despair. Well, you know what? Sometimes that temptation to lose hope is powerful. What future do we face in Appalachia? The need to feed our families is very real, but for many, the struggle to find jobs means they must cast their nets further and further away from home. We Appalachians know that it isn't resignation that keeps us here. It's pride for our mountains, our deep roots in our local communities, and our strong connection with home. Part of what we love about Appalachia is the natural beauty, the simple sound of clean snow crunching under our feet. Today, we're going to explore what it means to people in Appalachia to have gas companies bring jobs, but they're also bringing many changes to local communities. But before we talk about pipelines and fracking, we wanted to go outside in the wintry outdoors and just explore this vast, snow-dusted place we call home. I recently took my kids on a hike that I first took when I was a child with my Papa Charlie at Twin Falls State Park in Wyoming County, West Virginia. There was something very magical about bundling up and going out in the woods to see a glistening waterfall with crystallized ice formations framing the scenery. The snow was only a dusting, still revealing the railroad ties that helped form the trail. But when it comes to exploring the wintry outdoors in deep snow, it can be hard to get started, especially if you're new to it. You really need a guide, and that's what Allegheny Front contributor Ashley Murray found out when she tried snowshoeing for the first time. She joined beginners to the sport, as well as seasoned outdoor trip leaders, Bill Grove and Katie Getze, as they strapped on snowshoes in the Laurel Highlands of Pennsylvania.
The toe pick is for going downhill or uphill. It allows you to dig in, grab a hold of the snow. The next bigger cleat that you see right here is underneath the forefoot.
So I'm in Rockwood, PA, snowshoeing with about 20 people. It's a beginner snowshoeing trek, as they call it, snowshoeing 101. And we are just starting out on the trail.
My name's Tom Cosgrove. I'm an assistant trip leader on this trip. We are going to be walking around Camp Soul. We're just going to be doing a big loop around this lake. I'm thinking around two-ish miles. How you doing so far with the snowshoes?
I think I'm doing okay. Yeah, oh boy, just slid a little there. Yes, spoke too soon.
All right.
And what's your name?
Elizabeth Engelman. Call me Lizzie. In many situations, I'm Engelwoman. I'm a longtime Pittsburgh resident, and I'm a southern gal from Florida, and for 32 years I've hated winter and decided this year I'm gonna like it. And practically Broke my neck to get here today. Worked till 3 this morning.
Oh my God.
But I wasn't going to miss this. And I'm hooked. It will be snowshoe for me. Forever.
Well, you look like a natural already.
Oh, thanks. Fake it till you make it. Well, I hope you're having fun.
I am. This is very fun.
Because this is a hoot.
So we're walking along the trail still. We're getting deeper into the woods. It's just really gorgeous, really quiet. The trees are covered in snow. The only sound you hear are just the quiet conversations of the participants on this hike.
In the snow, we want to look at the terrain. You'll see where the tree hump is. You'll see where the snow is covered to rock.
Can you talk about the appeal of snowshoeing? I mean, as far as I can tell so far, and this is only my first time, it seems like a pretty safe winter activity. I mean, I've been skiing once before, and it was pretty terrifying.
Well, you're talking about a sport that everybody can do. It's low impact. You can make it as aerobic as you want. It's up to you. You're not going to fall going 50 miles an hour. You know, our mission is to get people outside to enjoy the natural resources of the area. And that's what we're doing.
We're really beginner friendly, which is great. It gives people a way to get outside when, you know, maybe they'd be uncomfortable doing something. Like today, we had snowshoes for everybody. You know, you don't have to go and buy them and make a big purchase. You can just try it and see if it's something you like to do.
I'm Doreen.
Doreen?
Karis. I've been wanting to try snowshoeing for a long time. My family skis. I'm unable to do that. I've got very arthritic knees. So I thought, well, I can walk. I should be able to do this. So my choices are sit around in the lodge, read a book, or go to the spa, or stay at home. This is much better than all of those things. Although the spa's a nice trip, too.
And we are about to end the hike, but it is uphill to the car. So, yes, it is wearing me out. From Rockwood, PA, on a snowshoeing hike, I'm Ashley Murray for the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. On our website, wvpublic.org, you can find information about upcoming snowshoeing adventures that Venture Outdoors has planned this year. We've also posted directions to another snowshoeing hike near the Cranberry Backcountry in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. If you want to get outside and don't mind a little bit of a hike up Kennison Mountain, this time of year on a clear day, you can see for miles. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When we come back, we'll find out how the natural gas boom is driving the need to build more gas pipelines and what people think about it.
Jesus spoke these words in the book of Matthew. You can't serve God and money too. You gotta make up your mind what you want to do. Have you got the money or the money got you? Living here in a world of free, so much free and liquor too. Sometimes I wonder what our country's coming to. Have you got the money or the money got you?
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You got no money, but these all show. Now come on, friends, now who's a fool and who? Have you got the money or the money got you?
Some politicians and residents are touting the natural gas industry as the best solution to bring jobs back to central and northern Appalachia. New technology now allows energy companies to blast water, sand, and chemicals deep into the ground at high pressures to release gas from shale formations. With hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, gas companies are able to drill for more natural gas in some areas in Appalachia. And while some people are finding well-paying jobs and economic opportunities because of the boom in the gas industry, others are finding discontent. Almost 100 residents from several counties throughout West Virginia are filing lawsuits for nuisance and negligence against companies engaged in horizontal drilling activities. Glynis Board went out to Doddridge County to catch a glimpse of life in the growing natural gas fields of the state.
Lyndia Ervolina is standing in her front yard, 75 feet or so from Route 50. She's pointing to several heavy trucks passing by.
They're hauling water, they're hauling that sand, they're hauling silica sand, they're hauling frack fluid, they're hauling, you name it, they haul it in and out. They bring all
drill cuttings, heavy machinery, pipe. Ervolina sees it all from her front porch. For the past 30 years, she and her husband have lived in her charming home that rests in a nook off of Route 50. She says traffic became an issue 4 or 5 years ago when horizontal drilling took off in this neck of Doddridge County. She's not an industry expert, but she knows what it's like to live surrounded by horizontal drilling operations.
They're doing pipeline, they're doing wells, they're doing new pads, they're doing, you know, anything they can build. They've got storage areas back in there where they haul all their pipe in, and there's just so much activity.
Not only is the industry moving around Ervolina on wheels, gas has moved into her front yard, literally. She has this beautiful garden, and it's clearly seen a lot of work, but it's also clearly fallen into disrepair. And standing there, it's really not hard to guess why. There's this heavy odor wafting through the air that makes you worry about the presence of open flames. Ervolina says the smell is coming from across the street.
I have a condensate tank up there that they blow off, that they put in when they put the pipeline in. That's right across the road. And, you know, they could have chosen so many places to put that. I have no idea why they put it right across from our house. It's a tank that cleans the gas as it goes through to get a lot of the impurities and stuff off of it. And they just blow it off into the air. So when it's blown off into the air, it comes straight to my house.
Ervolina's story is one of many in the northern gas fields. Over the past year, about 50 cases and 100 claimants have filed suit, mostly in Harrison and Doddridge counties, but also Pleasants, Kanawha, Ritchie, Marion, and Monongalia. Citizens are filing suit against several companies, including Colorado-based Antero Resources, West Virginia-based Hall Drilling, and Pennsylvania-based EQT. The negligence and nuisance claims are coming from residents and property owners like Ervolina who live in the vicinity of oil or natural gas drilling activities. I drove around and spoke to other residents in the community who are also worried about things like air and noise pollution, but few are willing to publicly voice concerns because they don't want to openly criticize economic development in their rural backyards. Some members of the community get paid to do odd jobs for gas companies like monitor traffic or help clean up spills. Still others, like Ervolina, who are filing suits, have been advised by legal counsel not to discuss their issues. And if their cases are settled, they're often legally forbidden from discussing problems as part of the legal agreement. Attorney and co-founder of the West Virginia Surface Owner Rights Organization, Dave McMahon.
Interestingly, there have not been that many nuisance cases brought. There occasionally are, but that's because there's often not enough money in one nuisance case for a lawyer to be able to make that, to bring the case on a contingent fee basis. And very few people living out there in the country have the money to pay a good lawyer an hourly basis to bring one of these cases.
McMahon isn't a lawyer filing these cases, but he was present when the 50 cases filed in the state were compiled into a mass litigation suit, which is when many similar cases are compiled to be heard and judged on simultaneously to avoid conflicting rulings and clogging the court system. McMahon says here in West Virginia, this kind of legal action is really sometimes the only recourse people have.
The Horizontal Well Act that was passed a couple years ago didn't do what it should have for surface owners, we say. There were a number of studies that were put in instead of actually surface owner protections. The studies were conducted by WVU and other places. The studies made recommendations to give better protection to surface owners, but neither the DEP nor the legislature have made those changes. So what we have to hope is that these actions of the courts will protect people and will deter the industry from doing the kinds of nuisance things that they've been doing.
Meanwhile, back along Route 50 in Doddridge County, Lyndia Ervolina doesn't own any mineral rights under her two-acre lot. She really doesn't have anything to gain from living within arm's reach of such industry. Companies have no legal obligation to explain what they're doing, even if it's happening right across the street. And there's no forum to facilitate communication. So she and her family are often left in the dark to wonder and worry. She says moving away isn't off the table, as many others have already done, but it's a painful thought to entertain.
My house has no value now, and I wonder if I should take what money we have left and invest it in the house, or just figure that we might have to move out of here. And I mean, it kind of leaves you just in this limbo. I just turned 67, so my husband's 68, and you know. It's kind of hard to start over.
We reached out to Antero, EQT, Hall Drilling, and the West Virginia Oil and Natural Gas Association for comment on this story, but we didn't get any replies. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Doddridge County.
State Impact's Marie Cusick has been following the gas boom in Pennsylvania. She reports that the pace of gas production is driving energy companies to build more pipelines that are needed to transport the new gas to markets.
They've already drilled thousands of wells, but now energy companies are building their own sort of interstate highway system, a network of pipelines. Matt Henderson is with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research, and he says more than $10 billion in pipeline projects have already been announced for Pennsylvania.
Production has outpaced anybody's wildest expectations. When you look back 4 or 5 years ago, we far exceeded the projections. So the operators were found in a position where production is so high, we need to get this out. So there's a sense of urgency.
So far, Houston-based Cabot Oil and Gas has been able to ship its gas out of northeastern Pennsylvania on three existing interstate pipelines.
These pipelines have been around for quite some time, and you probably call them legacy pipelines.
That's company spokesman Bill DeRogers. He says Cabot is partnering with other companies on new projects to ease bottlenecks in the system, like the Constitution Pipeline, which was recently approved by federal regulators to carry Marcellus gas to New York and New England. But there's an even bigger one on the horizon.
The Atlantic Sunrise is another pipeline project that will actually head south.
The $3 billion line would cut through 10 central Pennsylvania counties. If it's approved by regulators, it could be operational in 2 years. DeRozier says it will start near Cabot's operations in Susquehanna County and go as far south as Alabama.
And it'll actually bring gas along the eastern seaboard markets as far south for Cabot's interest to Cove Point, which is an exportation terminal where Cabot's looking forward to exporting to Japan.
Fetching a higher price for its gas overseas would obviously be good news for Cabot. But this surge in gas infrastructure has also sparked a new round of fracking-related fears and concerns.
Wake up, FERC! Wake up, FERC!
More than 24 protesters were arrested last summer outside the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. It oversees interstate pipelines and export facilities like the Cove Point Terminal, which is along the Chesapeake Bay. They argue sending more gas abroad will mean more environmental harm from drilling back home.
You're killing our future! Oh, f*** me!
It's not hard to find passionate opposition to pipelines elsewhere, particularly in southeastern Pennsylvania, which has been largely untouched by the drilling boom so far. Many people fear gas companies will use eminent domain to seize their property. New York landowners along the route of the Constitution pipeline recently received letters threatening exactly that. And because siting interstate pipelines is a federal decision, it's unlikely Pennsylvania's state Supreme Court ruling on Act 13, which affirmed the right of local governments to zone gas development, will have much of an effect. Mark Clatterbuck's home in Lancaster County is along a proposed route for the Atlantic Sunrise pipeline. He's doubtful federal regulators will listen to his concerns about safety and environmental degradation.
I have essentially zero hope that FERC will take that seriously.
It's true that FERC often approves pipelines, but the agency says it doesn't track just how often. But industry representatives argue the public's fears are overblown. There are already about 2.5 million miles of gas pipelines in the United States. Fatal accidents do happen, but they're relatively rare. According to federal data, 362 people have died over the past 20 years. 25 of those were in Pennsylvania. Still, environmental groups claim they get left out of the planning process. Katie Dunlap with Trout Unlimited says she feels like they missed the boat when the drilling boom began 7 years ago.
We have, over time, tried to have discussions with companies about getting involved in the planning up front. And what we've been told time and time again is that most of this planning has already been done.
Anthony Cox works for UGI Energy Services. That's the company behind the proposed Penn East pipeline, which would carry gas from northeastern Pennsylvania into New Jersey. He understands many people may not like a new interstate transmission line in their backyard, but argues there are other economic benefits, like ensuring the flow of gas to cut down on price volatility.
But it goes beyond that to talk about increased natural gas, which leads to increased competitiveness for local businesses, which increases jobs and lowers taxes for everybody. So there's a much bigger macroeconomic story to be told here.
It's a story that will continue to unfold as the shale gas boom enters another phase in the Commonwealth. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Speculation has begun in eastern Kentucky about a potentially large reserve of oil and natural gas trapped about 2 miles underground. If the Rogersville shale is proven productive, it would be the first major oil and gas project in the region. As WFPL's Erica Peterson reports, this has excited the industry, but some residents are worried about the toll hydraulic fracturing or fracking would take on human health and the environment.
The Rogersville Shale is a Cambrian-age formation that lies under much of eastern Kentucky and extends into West Virginia. Two test wells have already been drilled. But Dave Harris of the Kentucky Geological Survey says because the operators have drilled the wells under a special provision called a stratigraphic test permit, the results are confidential.
It is a potentially productive formation. We just don't know how prolific this formation might be.
But increased activity by land agents in several eastern Kentucky counties suggests that the oil and gas industry thinks Rogersville could be very profitable. Jim Sheff is the director of forest preservation nonprofit Kentucky Heartwood and a volunteer with a new citizen group called Frack Free Foothills. He says he's worried about the growing body of evidence suggesting that fracking has a negative effect on both human health and the environment.
Increased fatalities, increased illnesses, increased birth defects, contaminated groundwater, contaminated surface water, lower property values. All of those things come to a community when somebody chooses to allow to lease their minerals.
If oil and gas companies begin tapping the Rogersville Shale, it'll be the first time large-scale hydraulic fracking happens in Kentucky. Erica Peterson, WFPL News.
Later in the show, we'll hear how some members of Congress are hoping to speed up the review process for these pipeline projects and find out how this could affect possible pipeline projects in your area. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a regular segment on Inside Appalachia where we find out the story about how an Appalachian town got its name. Back in December, we heard that the town of Bug Tussle, Kentucky, was supposedly named because they once had an overrun population of doodlebugs. We have another town this week also named after an insect. What is it? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. So back to our What's in a Name quest. Today we're looking at a town that got its name for sand flies. It's also a town that's home to the famous Punxsutawney Phil that we see each year on Groundhog Day. Yes, Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania got its name from a Native American word for sand flies. known as Town of Punkies, a word for sand gnats, became Punxsutawney. Punxsutawney is in the hills of the Appalachian Plateau. The area was used by Native Americans as they traveled between the Allegheny and Susquehanna rivers. At various times, the area was inhabited by Shawnee, Delaware, Seneca, and Iroquois. So that's what's in the name of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Wondering how the heck another town got its name? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag what's in a name. While the fame of Punxsutawney's groundhog is nationally recognized, this week, in honor of Groundhog Day, we wanted to shine a spotlight on a very special pair of West Virginia groundhogs who perhaps aren't celebrated as well as they deserve.
French Creek Freddy is West Virginia's groundhog prophet. Back in 1978, Bill Vanskoy, the superintendent here at what used to be called the Game Farm, said a newspaper reporter called him the day before Groundhog Day and asked if they had a groundhog and if he had seen a shadow. So Mr. Vanskoy told the reporter whatever was appropriate to the weather that they were having. And then the reporter asked what the groundhog's name was. Mr. Vanskoy said the first thing that came into his mind, French Creek Freddy. That was 35 years ago. The Game Farm is now called the West Virginia Wildlife Center. French Creek Freddy lives here, but he was asleep when I visited, and one of his handlers explained that they don't like to disturb him before February 2nd. Kenny Hall has been the handler for French Creek Freddy for almost two decades.
I've been here for 24 years, and we've seen all different weather conditions throughout this thing. And this is on February 2nd. We kind of do it just to break up the long winter that has been, and we see the chance for early spring.
2 years ago, Kenny also took on a new role as the official French Creek mascot. And that means he's the one who gets to wear the copper-toned groundhog costume. And of course, he also wears a giant black top hat. But for the real French Creek Freddy, Groundhog Day is, among other things, probably the most confusing day of the year.
I know one year he was really lively and he took out and ran over the pen. So we had to go get him and come back to the camera. He was camera shy to that. But we've seen a lot of different activities with when you're using a live animal and it's been just woken up for that day, you could see about anything.
For Groundhog Day, the center gives out free hot chocolate and cookies to the crowd. Judy Channel also works at the West Virginia Wildlife Center, and she helps organize the public event.
And the kids make posters, you know, we love Freddy, and you know, people are just really showing Freddy a lot of love, and so we want to provide them a good time and, you know, let them know they came for a reason.
What began in the 1970s as a sort of inside joke between the superintendent here and the media has turned into a major event for this small town.
Our attendance has gone up tremendously. Last year it was on a Sunday, and we had an attendance of over 400 people. We had some folks last year that traveled from Georgia. They had been to Punxsutawney to see Phil, and they were going to work their way around the country over the years to see the different groundhogs, and last year was their turn to come and see French Creek Freddy.
And it all leads me to ask this. Why do all these people travel here in the dead of winter to see a sleepy groundhog?
I think it's like Kenny said, you know, it's you go through Thanksgiving, Christmas, and all that, you know, all that rush, and then it just kind of slows down, and you've got, you know, two and a half months of winter weather to look forward to. And I think Groundhog Day, it's just a good opportunity to get out regardless of what the weather is, you know, and then it's uplifting to know that, you know, if Freddy doesn't see a shadow, we had an early spring, so in 6 weeks you're going to see some better weather, you know, something to look forward to.
And while the tradition of Groundhog Day might seem silly, there is a biological reason why this tradition exists. This is a natural time when groundhogs usually begin to wake from their hibernation.
We have seen in the last week or so a groundhog out in the wild. So these ones that we've got in that real consistent temperature right now, they're probably still asleep, but in the next 2 or 3 days they'll wake up.
Every now and then, though, French Creek Freddy's biological clock is a little bit late.
If he is asleep, we will just pick him up, and that's only happened twice in the 22 years that I've been here.
French Creek Freddy and Punxsutawney Phil don't always agree. Last year, French Creek Freddy called for an early spring. Punxsutawney said 6 more weeks of winter. Who was right? That's still up for debate. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in French Creek.
Another groundhog in Appalachia has a standing appointment with the university president. Concord Charlie of Concord University offers his predictions and insights on the duration of winter. The president relays the forecast to guests at an annual breakfast. But there's a different groundhog watcher each year. The Grand Groundhog Watcher honor is bestowed on an individual who has positively impacted life and culture in West Virginia. This year, the prestigious position is held by the university's head football coach, Garen Justice.
Well, it's an honor. I look on a list, there's never been a football coach or any type of coach to be on the list. So that says volumes of what we were able to accomplish this past season. So I'm very honored. I don't really know what it has in store for me, but I'm very excited.
The Grand Groundhog Watcher usually gives a colorful speech at the breakfast. Justice led the Mountain Lions through an unprecedented season in 2014 that included a conference championship, region championship, and an appearance in the national semifinals. Justice will address the Groundhog Day breakfast audience, sharing the spotlight with Concord Charlie. The Concord Charlie tradition was originated in 1978 by the late Professor R.T. Tom Hill, a chairman of both the Geography Department and the Appalachian Studies Program at Concord. Hill started the Groundhog Day breakfast as a means to celebrate a bit of Appalachian heritage and highlight the program. In 2014, citizens in West Virginia learned that energy companies have their sights on at least two major natural gas pipeline proposals. If either one of these pipelines were approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, it could mean that the Mountain State could see a lot of new construction and manufacturing jobs. The economic benefits are motivating some members of Congress to direct the FERC to review pipeline projects quicker than the usual 12 to 18-month proposed period. On January 21st, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution called the Natural Gas Pipeline Permitting Reform Act. The resolution directs the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to approve or deny pipeline projects within 12 months after receiving a complete application. Our producer, Roxy Todd, explains.
In West Virginia, there are at least two major pipeline projects in the pre-filing stage with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Mountain Valley Pipeline will each go through environmental analysis and a public comment period before being approved or denied by the federal government. Tamara Young Allen is the representative with FERC. She says her agency takes about a year to 18 months to make the recommendations for most pipeline projects.
And that includes cultural resources, wetlands, endangered species, impacts on waterways, geology, agricultural land, etc.
The House of Representatives recently passed a resolution which, if it became a law, would direct FERC to shorten the length of time to review all pipeline projects to 1 year. If FERC fails to review a given project within that time, the resolution states, the project will automatically be approved.
We should not be allowing these permits to go for years before they are approved or denied.
Congressman McKinley is one of the co-sponsors of House Resolution 161, known as the Natural Gas Pipeline Permitting Reform Act. He says more gas pipeline projects would bring manufacturing jobs to West Virginia. He also says pipelines are needed to help our country export natural gas overseas.
If the Ukraine situation is just an example, it's just one example, by virtue of not having be able to get exporting natural gas from America, they had to rely on Russia.
Now, according to energy companies we spoke with, neither the Mountain Valley Pipeline nor the Atlantic Coast Pipeline have plans to transport West Virginia gas to export terminals. The proposed pipelines are being built to transport gas to markets throughout West Virginia, Virginia, and North Carolina. But, as Representative McKinley points out, in the future, the gas could still make its way to foreign markets if energy companies built that type of infrastructure.
Oh my, yes, yes. We need to be exporting our natural gas, our LNG. It's a very interconnected issue here of whether or not we want to continue to explore to get natural gas, and secondly, then the pipeline to connect it and get it to market. But one of the biggest markets is going to be exporting. So you see how it all works together.
But the prospect of exporting West Virginia's natural gas concerns many West Virginia landowners.
at one of the public meetings held in Monroe County last year to discuss the Mountain Valley Pipeline, Cookie Cole said her family has been living in the area for five generations.
The gas, it's not going to benefit us whatsoever, and it'll be running 2 billion cubic feet of gas a day through our county that's headed to export terminals. Why should we destroy our county so somebody else can benefit from it?
Determining whether a pipeline would benefit citizens like Cookie Cole and whether or not a pipeline would have damaging impacts on their land, these are some of the questions that FERC investigates during their extensive review process. Jody Moore, with the West Virginia chapter of the Sierra Club, says that for the FERC review to work, the agency needs time to consider all the issues.
The pipelines that we're hearing so much about, we've never seen pipelines this large. The potential impact radiuses from a 42-inch pipeline explosion are just massive. The difficulty, should something go wrong of getting to these areas, and again, protecting our wildlife and habitat.
Moore is describing the proposed 550-mile Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which could run through 2 national forests in West Virginia. The Natural Gas Pipeline Permitting Reform Act, meanwhile, has been approved by the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. Whether or when that resolution might be taken up by the Senate is unclear. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
We've posted a link on our website where you can find information about how to comment on pipeline projects in your area. Go to wvpublic.org. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When we come back, we'll hear from people in communities that have recently seen a lot of drilling. Today we're hearing from people in Appalachia discussing how fracking or oil and gas drilling is affecting communities in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. In one Pennsylvania town, locals say drilling ruined their water. But the state has said drilling had nothing to do with the bad water. So what happened? Well, scientists are still trying to figure that out. Meanwhile, a small country church is delivering water to residents. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has this look at what has been happening to the Woodlands community.
Lee Dreyer is the pastor of the White Oak Springs Presbyterian Church. It's located on a country road about an hour north of Pittsburgh. Every Monday, he wheels out big cardboard boxes from what used to be a Sunday school classroom into the church parking lot. People pull up in cars and trucks and load the boxes in the back. What's in the boxes? 6-gallon jugs of spring water. You've heard of a food drive? This is a water drive. Dreyer's been doing this for 2 years. The church buys the water using donations and gives it to families from a nearby neighborhood called the Woodlands. Many in the neighborhood blame problems with their water on drilling rigs nearby. Dreyer has seen the water firsthand.
We went out there to the Woodlands, and one guy showed us some of the water that came out of his spigot, and it was about the color of used motor oil.
One of the people picking up today is John Fair. Fair says he drilled a well 3 years ago at his home. The water was perfect, he said. Then it started smelling bad, like rotten eggs, and it looked like mud. 3 years later, he gets all his drinking water from the water drive.
And I say, yeah, you can't drink it. Oh, yeah, just keep doing what you do. Do your wash and, take a shower and do your dishes. That's about all you can do. You can't use it for drinking or anything,
At his home, Fair turns on the water in his kitchen sink.
You want to taste it?
I'll taste it.
Ooh. Oof. Tastes like, it was like a rusty chain in the cup for, tastes like rust.
Is that the way water's supposed to be?
Probably not.
The company drilling the nearby gas wells, Rex Energy, initially provided Fair and his neighbors with drinking water. But that ended in 2012, when the state said gas activities were not the cause of the water problems. The state's Department of Environmental Protection found water had high levels of iron and manganese before drilling began. And the EPA agreed. Some in the Woodlands say they've had problems with their well water in the past, that it smelled bad, or that after rainstorms it became dirty. But they say it got worse when drilling commenced, and some of them, including Fair, are suing RECs because of it. What went wrong with the water? John Stoltz is a microbiologist at Duquesne University who's trying to answer that question. He's looked at the same data the DEP has.
And we see that, you know, a lot of the well data that we have, or the wells, are impacted by mine drainage.
Mine drainage, not brine from gas drilling or chemicals used in fracking. The area does have abandoned coal mines nearby, so maybe mine water has been in the water wells all along? From the interviews and tests he's done, Stoltz thinks the water got worse around the time drilling began.
Good number of people no longer have potable water. It seems to coincide with when the drilling commenced and went, you know, full bore, so to speak.
With funding from the Heinz Endowments and the Colcom Foundation, Stoltz is trying to piece together an answer. He says it's a complicated picture underground.
If we were pristine, no one had ever drilled a well in Pennsylvania, no one had ever mined a mine in Pennsylvania, and they started drilling this, it would be a lot easier. But, you know, we have close to 1 million wells that have been drilled prior to all this activity. So that's a lot of holes in the ground.
And Stoltz thinks maybe one hole in the ground might have influenced another. But Rex Energy disputes this interpretation. The company didn't return phone calls for the story, but in the past has stood by the DEP's findings that its activities had nothing to do with water problems in the community. Water contamination concerns have followed the boom in the state's Marcellus Shale gas fields since it began. Gas activities damaged groundwater in more than 160 cases across the state, according to DEP records obtained by the Times Tribune of Scranton. And last month, a drilling rig north of Pittsburgh punched through an abandoned coal mine, forcing mine drainage into a nearby stream and impacting groundwater in nearby homes. But these incidents represent a minority of cases in a state with more than 8,000 Marcellus Shale gas wells. And the industry points out that the state has steadily improved its construction standards for drilling. Still, few hard numbers exist on how safe shale gas drilling has been for groundwater. Sue Brantley is a geochemist at Penn State who's trying to change that. She's been putting together groundwater tests from across the Marcellus region, like one that appeared on her screen from northeastern Pennsylvania.
Here's barium. This is one of the signatures for Marcellus.
Her project, called the Shale Network, is funded by the National Science Foundation and has over 1 million of these data points so far. But she wants more.
Well, the data that we're really interested in right now is data that was collected before drilling by gas companies.
Before they drill a well, gas companies typically test nearby groundwater. This can help shield them from contamination claims. These results are locked away, though, because legally they're the private property of the homeowner, like a patient's medical records. There's another hurdle for scientists like Brantley, the legal system. In cases of alleged groundwater contamination, landowners will often sue a drilling company.
Very often, the companies will settle with people if they'll sign a non-disclosure agreement, and then the data doesn't come out. And that's just really, it's a big loss.
Brantley might have found a workaround. Gas companies send their results to the DEP. Her lab is working with the DEP to take identifying information like names and addresses out of these tests and put them into their database. A lot of these results have to be hand-entered into the computer. Slowly, a picture is starting to emerge.
We, in our database, have not found a lot of incidents of contamination due to the shale gas industry. There are some incidents for sure, but we haven't found a lot of them.
Another problem for scientists is just nature itself. Fred Baldessari is a former DEP geologist. He's been studying underground methane migration. In a study he did with help from gas companies, he found that gas that looked like it was from the Marcellus Shale was actually hanging out in rocks closer to the surface. He thinks this has tricked other researchers into thinking gas found in shallow parts of the ground was the result of drilling or fracking in the Marcellus.
Some researchers were suggesting that when you see that deep gas, it must be from the Marcellus up in the groundwater system. And we're saying that's not an accurate statement.
The confusing nature of studying the underground doesn't obscure Baldessari's overall assessment that there should be a way to do fracking without contaminating groundwater, and that the industry's practices now are better and safer than they were 5 years ago. But exactly how safe is it now? To find that out, scientists say, more study is needed. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Since this story first aired last year, the White Oak Springs Presbyterian Church has continued their water drive. They are now up to 40 families receiving water and accepting donations. Some people are concerned that gas drilling could contaminate their drinking water, and a few folks have even decided to begin monitoring their local rivers. So despite the cold weather this December, State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary went wading in Brady Run with one of those citizen scientists.
I'm following Joanne Martin down a steep gravel slope, ducking low tree branches and trying not to fall on my butt.
There you go. Okay.
We made it.
She's not going to fall now.
Our trek takes us to the muddy bank of Brady Run, a stream in Beaver County in western Pennsylvania. Martin has been coming to Brady Run for 3 years, testing the water for signs of pollution from natural gas drilling. There's a producing well pad just about a half mile from here. First, Martin plunks in a wood measuring stick to check stream depth.
So then I go up upstream a little bit because I don't want to take water from where I disturbed the sediment, because I don't want any of that in the sample.
She takes a small cup, the kind you might use at a doctor's office, and dips it into the stream.
Ah, it's cold!
Back on the bank, Martin uses a pocket-sized monitor to test her sample.
It is measuring the conductivity of the water. The lower the conductivity, the less potential toxicity of the water. So if there's higher conductivity, it would mean that there might be some metals discharging into the stream.
Martin is not a professional scientist, so why is she standing in the middle of a frigid stream on a December morning? Martin is what is called a citizen scientist, and she's been trained by this woman.
I'm Julie Bastine, and I direct the Alliance for Aquatic Resource Monitoring, acronym ALARM, based out of Dickinson College.
For much of its 28 years, ALARM has encouraged citizen science to help communities answer their own questions about the health of their local watersheds. Then the shale boom hit. Vastine says the big question lately has been how all the drilling and fracking and laying of new pipelines might be affecting Pennsylvania's waterways.
There are limited resources by state agencies, regional agencies to do monitoring, and so it's obvious that we need more boots on the ground to be able to collect water quality data.
ALARM has trained more than 500 volunteers in its strict protocol for sampling local streams and for reporting potential problems to state regulators. Vastine says some people are drawn to the program because they like being part of scientific research. Others, like Joanne Martin, got involved out of worry about fracking's impact on the environment.
When I first started testing, I thought, wow, this would be a perfect opportunity to really, you know, ring the alarm bells and maybe halt the whole production if we actually were to find some contamination in the stream. And really, in the end, no, I don't hope that that happens. But sometimes those are the ways to call attention, is when there is a problem.
That's the key for people like Martin. They want the data they're collecting to get regulators and politicians to pay attention.
If you have facts, you can send it in and say, we want this reported. But until we get those facts, we're on our own.
Janice Winshue and her husband Chuck are taking part in a study on air quality near gas development in Pennsylvania's Susquehanna County. Researchers from the University of London gave them an air monitor to keep on their front porch. Every few weeks, they upload the data from the monitor onto their computer. But here's what's different about this study. The researchers are primarily interested not in the air quality readings, but in what the residents do with the data once they're collected. Jennifer Gabrice is a sociologist leading the study.
Citizens are undertaking monitoring already because they have concerns about their environment. How might they actually develop those practices further in order to actually do something with that data, to actually have conversations with policymakers or regulators or even industry?
But should policymakers and regulators trust data from ordinary people motivated by worry? Citizen science has become a norm in fields like astronomy and birding. But some still question whether this method always produces good data. For example, can scientists trust water quality readings collected by people opposed to fracking? David Resnick is a bioethicist at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences.
There is the potential that they could bias their research in a similar kind of way that a company might when it has a financial interest at stake.
Resnick says the work of citizen scientists should be judged the way all science should be judged.
Is it good from a scientific perspective? Is it rigorous? But you also have to ask yourself, well, is it good from an ethical perspective? Does it follow the accepted ethical standards for research?
About a week and a half ago, Chuck Winshue noticed his air quality monitor had spiked to levels he'd never seen before. A message showed up on the screen.
Danger, unhealthy air.
So the Winshues called the State Department of Environmental Protection, who sent an inspector later that afternoon, along with an energy company representative.
They were very interested in getting here and to see what this thing was.
I'm sorry to say, I don't feel they were as interested in...
No, they weren't interested in what I was breathing that day. They were interested in, where'd you get this machine?
Exactly.
And why are you air monitoring? They kind of indicated, that's our job. And I'm like, well...
The Winshues say they still don't know exactly what caused their air monitor to spike that morning, but they believe the DEP would never have shown up if they didn't have that device on their porch. So for them, it's a start. I'm Katie Colinari, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from State Impact Pennsylvania and the Allegheny Front. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. Our theme music is by Andy Agnew Jr. Our What's in a Name music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special. Music in today's show was also provided by Bing Crosby, Billy Pollard, Jake Sheps, and the Glenville State Bluegrass Band.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.